And welcome, everybody, to the latest edition of the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com radio show. Your host, Ricky Hampton and Michael Robinson, columnist for the African American Athlete, coming to you on a Tuesday, here the last Tuesday in October. A lot of stuff going on in the world of sports. We're going to be visited by Pete McDaniel, the great golf writer, author of Uneven Lives, The Heroic Story of African Americans in Golf. Talk a little bit about Tiger Woods' 82nd PGA Tour win, and the NBA is also warming up. And former NBA legend Matt Calvin, the great point guard, is going to check in with us at about 9:35 and talk a little NBA. But right now, I need to go to my co-host and my frat brother, the great Michael Robinson. Michael, what's happening, my brother?
Yo, yo, yo. Well, you know, as you probably have seen over there in the D, we got fires and stuff going on out here. So we got that issue again. The air is not that great. It's still a little bit north of us, but it still can affect us down here. So we got that, and L.A. is getting stuff too. So the whole state is going through that drama. And, of course, the sad moment of the Warriors, you know, they got blown out the first couple
of
games. Yeah. I mean, it's funny how just the panic and the woe is me stuff going on. I mean, Draymond tried to, you know, backpedal on his statement about that we suck and all that. And, you know, of course, they're going to use that as fuel or put a chip on their shoulder so they can, I guess, go around all the comments that people are saying about that they're done, you know, without Kevin, without Clay, that they won't do anything. And, of course, a lot has been heaved on Steph. You know, can Steph carry a team by himself pretty much? And D'Angelo, you know, he had a pretty good first game, but I don't know. It's already detractors with him too. So it's interesting. And, of course, you know, now that they're in San Francisco, you know, you could say, well, people are kind of taking their mind off of them because the Niners are undefeated. So all the attention has kind of left the Warriors, and it's all about the Niners and Jimmy G and all them. So we'll see what happens there. Raiders are kind of just, you know, trudging along. You know, it's like, you know, lame duck year for them. And Sharks are kind of surprisingly shaky. They've had a weird start, and they had a horrible start, as a matter of fact. Then they had a good run, so we don't know what team we're going to have with them. And, of course, they lost one of their star players, Pavelski, is now down in Dallas. So it's just going to be – it's a lot of transitions going on out here. And, of course, basketball for Stanford, the great Tara Vanderveer, she's getting started tonight. I would have been there, but it would just been too much of a hassle. But they have an exhibition game against China, the Chinese team. And, of course, they have the young lady, the new freshman, that's a dunker. So that's going to be very, very interesting to see this
What's her name, Mike?
Her name is Fran. I can't remember her last name top of my head. But yeah, I think there's Fran. And they got another freshman that was like player of the year. So, I mean, Tyler had a great recruiting year this time. So it's going to be real fun to watch them this year. And, of course, the men – it'll be exciting, too, because they play Kansas here. So it's going to be a lot going on in college basketball. So if you can't get over to the uber-expensive Chase Center for the Warriors, I mean, you got the college basketball. And both the men and the women will play over at the Chase Center. So that might be one of my opportunities, and we'll see if I can get to a Warrior game. But from what I understand from the media, parking is absolutely unavailable pretty much. And then – you know, people talking about all these different routes they're taking to get over there. I'm like, man, I don't know if I want to go through all that. You know, so
right.
So we'll see what
right.
happens with that. But as of now, you know, the Warriors are, you know, are they going to make the playoffs? Are they going to be the middle pack? We don't know. Will Clay come back?
Then
they speculate that he might not come back. Yeah. So,
number one, do you think Russell and Westbrook can play? I mean, not Russell and Westbrook, but Russell and Steph play together?
Well, you know, that's the funny thing about the whole Warrior situation. When Steph was a rookie, they were talking about how he couldn't play with Monte Ellis. And some of these same so-called fans, and I always get on them about this, they were talking about, man, get Steph out of here, man. We'd rather have Monte. And then they traded Monte for Bogut to the Bucks. Oh, you should have heard these people out here. They were like, oh, man, that was terrible. Get rid of Steph. Get rid of Steph. So then all of a sudden when they started winning championships, oh, no, no, I always supported Steph. Yeah, right. So, and, you know, because that's what
I remember
Steph was,
that.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying about, that's what I'm saying about Fickell and that why you can't take a lot of them that serious because it's like, come on, man, you guys were not that diehard back in the day. Stop with all the drama. So then, you know, now it's come – I don't want to say full circle, but it's come to, you know, a point where now Steph, you know, may have a situation where he might have a hard time playing with a younger player. But I think it could work it just long as D'Angelo has to really, really watch the way Steph plays and say, okay, let me learn how to feed off him and when I can take my shot, when I can do my thing. If you just come down just gunning, you know, that's going to cause problems because you're not running the offense. And that's the whole thing about their offense has been that flowing motion that they've done for their offense.
Yeah,
so
man,
it's hard to say.
When they,
like,
when they
so
really
early,
had it going, when they really had it going, it was a beautiful thing to see. Even though I was cheering against them, I got to stay.
Right.
They, yeah. I mean, they were just magnificent with their ball movement. But, hey, we're going to get back to basketball to our listening audience across the country and our international listeners. At around 9:35, we're going to be joined by former NBA and ABA legend Matt Calvin. He's going to check in with us, and we're going to talk a little NBA with Matt at around 9:45. But right now, we're going to switch gears and bring in our first guest, one of America's great golf writers and the author of one of the most important books ever written about golf, in my estimation, Uneven Lives, the heroic story of African Americans in golf, the one and only Mr. Pete McDaniel. Pete, welcome to the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. You're on with Ricky Hampton and Michael Robertson.
Thanks, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
Man, it is awesome to have you on. I had to get in touch with you today and get your thoughts on Tiger's 82nd PGA Tour win, the significance of that. You know, in my mind, he had already won them, already had the most victories, Pete, when you look at the little things in Sam Snead's career win mark, taking nothing against Sam, who's a great player. His swing would stand up to anybody's today. But the fact is, he did not win 82 tournaments by himself. But beyond that, your thoughts and impressions of what Tiger has accomplished.
I have to chuckle about that because that's been a debate between myself and some colleagues for years and years. But you know, it is what it is, history. Some people have that revisionist history that they, you know, they try to convince you that they're right with. But, you know, getting to the point, I was there for his first PGA Tour win, the Las Vegas Open. I'm sorry, the Las Vegas Invitational. And I tell stories about how he got in the playoff against Davis Love and his strategy. The strategy that he employed was match play because he was such a great match play competitor and coming off three consecutive U.S. Amateur Championships in which he came from behind and won. So on the first playoff hole, number 18, he hits this three-wood center cut fairway. Of course, Davis Love hits a driver, outdrives him like 40 yards, but it was strategic so that he could play his second shot before Davis Love played his to apply some pressure. And that's exactly how he took the final round in Japan. It was match play all the way, the final 18 holes. And you could tell he was in command from the very first doggone hole. And even though it got a little tight toward the end, he never lost his competitive edge. And that's what I was most proud of. He had his driver under control, and His emotions were in check, and he was just determined and focused, just like he was 20 years ago. I was so ecstatic for him because I know how much records mean to him. He'll try to shrug it off like, you know, it's just another milestone. But there were two records that he really focused on. The first one, of course, is Jack Nicklaus's 18 major championships. And the second one was Sam Snead's 82 victories. So for him to be able to accomplish the latter and still working on the former, I mean, it really bids well for the golfing public, his fans, the game itself, and, of course, those of us like you and I and you know, others who really pull for him all the time. So it was a great, great victory for a lot of reasons.
Hey, so Pete, let me ask you this question then. What about the casual fan that says, all right, this is great, Tiger, but I'm only concentrating on you winning these majors, and until you pass Jack, I can't really get into it. So what about the people that have that attitude? It's all about majors.
Now, that's a good question. You know, I don't pay those people any attention, to tell you the truth, because obviously they don't know how difficult it is to win on the PGA Tour.
Right.
When you consider that Charlie Sifford only won twice on the PGA Tour, and Calvin Peet, who was an extremely great player, the most successful African-American player before Tiger, won 12 times, and that was considered to be unbelievable from where he started from, having taken up the game when he was 23 years old. That was really miraculous. But if you look at the list of winners, I mean, they show it all the time now since Tiger won number 82, and you've got Phil Mickelson. I think he's been playing 3 or 4 years longer than Tiger on the PGA Tour. He has 44. Vijay Singh, I think, has maybe 40, somewhere around in there. And then they go all the way down. You've got DJ, Dustin Johnson. I think he's won 20 times. Rory McIlroy hadn't even broken into the 20s. So you have to think about the accomplishment in that light, how his peers have fared. And there was a time when Tiger was fully healthy, maybe about 6-7 years ago, before he sustained all the injuries and the surgeries and all that stuff, he was winning every third time out, which is absolutely amazing. Now I think it's about 25% of the tournaments that he plays in, he picks up a W. I think about that.
So that's one out of four. With all those injuries and the dry spell that he had, it was utterly remarkable. Hey, you know what, Pete? You mentioned Phil Mickelson. I was talking with somebody after the tournament the other day. I think Phil has 40-something victories. Hell of a player.
Yeah.
Hell of a player.
44. Yeah,
and
great player.
And we were thinking, without Tiger, he is the player of this generation, and he probably has at least another five majors.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Totally, totally agree with you. Phil, Tiger was Phil's nemesis. But he was the nemesis for Ernie Els, really,
yeah.
DJ Singh, all of the really top players who came along, David Duvall. Tiger was just so much better than they were. And that made the difference. And as Earl Woods would say, you know, Tiger's strength, yeah, he hit the ball a long way. He could hit any shot. But he was so mentally tough that he would literally beat them with his mind. And that, I don't know, I think Jack was the same way. I can remember vaguely because, you know, Jack got most of his victories before I really knew much about golf. But the mentally strong players like Jack Ben Hogan, you know, Arne Palmer, people like that separate themselves from the rest of the field because not only are they blessed and gifted physically, but when you add that mental focus, that mental superiority, a lot of people hate for me to say that, that word, but that's exactly what it is. Well, you know our history. Come on, Rick. You know, why is it we couldn't be a Major League Baseball pitcher? Why is it
right.
we couldn't be an NFL quarterback? You know?
Right.
That for the same reason. Why is it we couldn't conquer the tennis courts until Arthur Ashe and Althea Gibson came along? And, you know, we weren't supposed to be able to focus mentally and be smart enough to handle those positions of individual superiority, you know. And we proved all along that it's just a myth. So Tiger comes along. Not only is he physically gifted, he's the most physically gifted golfer on the scene, but he has this edge, and people can't quite figure out how the heck does he win all the time? How does he beat these guys in close competition? And there were a lot of our colleagues, Rick, who just wouldn't give it up. But he forced
it. Oh, yeah. and a lot of them made careers off of him. I think Brandon Chamblee, man. He's got one more PGA Tour win than I do. But he has made a career off bashing Tiger Woods. I mean, it's just utterly ridiculous. Hey, I want to ask you one thing. This is regarding Tiger, but I'm sure you heard about the NCAA and they're coming out. It's going to be compensation for athletes who, you know, coming down the road. Didn't Tiger, was he going to turn pro anyway? Wasn't it a situation where Arnold Palmer took him to dinner or something and he was going to be suspended or because Arnie paid for the dinner? Was that what the final straw for him? Or was he just going to go pro anyway? We know he was ready.
He was going to go pro anyway, but that certainly, you know, kind of hastened his decision. But, yeah, that was one of those rules that the NCAA has forced upon, you know, student-athletes. And it's so stupid. You can't even take somebody out to lunch. It was either dinner or lunch. Arnie took him out to eat and paid for it while Tiger was a sophomore at Stanford. And there was a big stink made about it, and Tiger eventually had to pay it back. He paid Arnie back, and he got out of it that way. But I think it was like, I don't even know, like $37, $40, something like that, something, some insignificant amount. But because it was Tiger Woods, and, you know, he's such a high-profile athlete, you know, they came down on him and tried to make an example of him. Things like that, like I said, probably hastened his decision, but I don't think he was going to stay at Stanford any longer than 2 years anyway. He had done everything he wanted to do. He won the NCAA individual championship. You know, team didn't win one, but he won one. So, and he was ready to go, you know. He told me, well, he said this not only to me, but on the record about his experience at Stanford and how amazing it was to be around student athletes who were so smart, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that was a cultural, you know, experiment for him that turned out to be really advantageous for him. And it showed him that, you know, all kinds of athletes can be good students. And, you know, and that was very important for him.
Yeah. You know, Mike and Pete, here in the Detroit area, a couple of years ago, Miles Bridges, who's now with the Charlotte Hornets, great young player at Michigan State, somebody took Miles' parents out to dinner. And it was, I know it was a $40 bill. They were ready to suspend him for the NCAA
tournament unless he had to pay $40 back. At the same time, Tom Izzo sitting up there, his coach, earning like $6 million a year.
Yeah. It is, you know, we kind of beat that horse to death. And finally, the NCAA, the situation in California really forced their hand. And I read someplace where North Carolina was going to follow suit and start paying the athletes, or at least allowing them to generate some income from their likeness and autographs and stuff like that. So, it's long overdue. We all know that. But these things take time to reverse, and this is one of them, and it's to the betterment for the student athlete and also the sport itself. Now, if they could do something about returning, the stipulation that that student athletes can turn pro right out of high school. That should be the next step, because not everybody was meant to go to college. That's a farce anyway,
right.
When you go to college for 1 year, then you get drafted. What a joke that is, huh?
That's now
slavery.
And also, when they get these degrees, when they accumulated nothing during that time. They just gave them classes that can get them by, and by the time they graduate, their degree is pretty much useless because it wasn't really a relevant degree in some cases. So that's the other joke of it, is that, you go through this with us for these 4 or maybe 5 years if we redshirt you, and you'll have this valuable degree that'll take you forever, take you through your life forever. But some of those degrees are like, what did they major in? Is it something that's going to be really relevant in the job market?
I can't say anything negative about getting a degree. I don't care what you get it in. If you spend four or five years at a school and at a college, some of the educational qualities are gonna and benefits are gonna rub off on you by osmosis. You'll be a better person for it. I certainly believe that. But the truth is, I would say fully 50%, maybe even more, of the student athletes who go to college, they have not a snowball's chance in hell of making it in the pros. So they need that education. But the other ones who are gifted enough to go right out of high school into the pros, they should be allowed to do so. And everybody knows it. It's just the NCAA refuses to give up on that cash cow, And the schools themselves, oh, my God, how hypocritical are they?
Hey, let me get everybody caught up here. You're listening to the AfricanAthlete.com radio show with Michael Robinson and Ricky Hampton. We're joined by the great Pete McDaniels, one of America's great golf writers, the author of Uneven Lives, the heroic story of African Americans in golf. Pete, I do want to get into this book with you because it's such an important book. For everybody who loves the game of golf to read, how did you come about deciding to do this? I think I know why you thought it was important.
I'll try to make a long story short, but I had just gone to work for Golf World magazine, and a good friend of mine, Craig Bourne, was working for Titleist. And Craig gave me a call one day. I think I was covering, my first couple of years there. I covered the colleges and I covered the LPGA, and I had a TV column. So I was kind of busy and, trying to make it and prove to not only myself but also my employer that I was pretty good and that I was worthy of being in the big show. So Craig calls me and says, I've been talking to Wally Uline, and who was the president and CEO of Titleist FootJoy, and he says that we'd like to do a documentary on blacks in golf, and he said, I know you come from Asheville, North Carolina, and I know that there's a black golf tour event being held all the time. Would you be interested in helping me with this documentary? I said, oh, yeah, Click, I got plenty of time. It's just all this stuff that I was doing, yeah. But it really intrigued me because I'd grown up knowing, Jim Thorpe and Chuck Thorpe and Lee Elder and James Black and all these great black players. And so anything that I could do to tell the story of African-Americans in golf, I was happy to do. So we started doing that. We went to the Skyview Open in my hometown, and they shot some film of James Black and Chuck Thorpe and these guys playing. And then we got back to Craig got back to the office and showed his boss what he had. And I got another phone call and telling me that Wally wanted me to come, Wally Ewing wanted me to come to Massachusetts and sit up for a sit-down. So I get there, and Wally says, Pete, I think we've gotten the cart before the horse. I think we need a book on this first. And you're the man to write it. And I said, okay, that sounds good to me. And that's how the project began. And Craig did a lot of the research, a lot of the legwork. And I knew a lot of the black golfers, and so I interviewed most of the ones that, I'd seen play and covered on the PGA Tour as well. And that's how it came about. Dr. Sinnett, Calvin Sinnett, had written his book, Forbidden Fairways.
Forbidden Fairways, right.
Yeah, a great book. So he had kind of forged the path for me. All I had to do was kind of follow in his footsteps. So I called him and asked him, I said, Doc, this is a great book. I'm not going to read it, but I kind of flipped through the pages. I said, would you mind if my researcher kind of followed your trail and, dug up the facts for my book? And he said he didn't care at all, so... That's exactly what Craig did. He called Dr. Sinnett and asked him, where'd you get this nugget from, Doc? And Doc would tell him, right. And he'd go research it and bring it back to me. And that's how it was done. I refused to read Doc's book until I finished mine. And so that's how the book came about. It was very well received. A lot of the black players read it and, sent me notes and gave me telephone calls and how grateful they were. But the biggest impact that the book had was on the on black women. There was a group in D.C., and when I had my first big book signing in D.C., the president, past president of that organization, came to the book signing. And I'm sitting there, and I must have autographed 100 copies of the book, and she had waited in line very patiently, and she came up to me, and she was crying. And I asked her, what was wrong? And she said, finally, someone told our story. And then, a tear came to my eye as well because it was so emotional. It was one of those connections that, it totally caught me off guard. And that was the response I had looked for. And that's the one I got.
Wow. Wow. Mike, you got something for Pete?
Yeah, just the fact that when you talked about Calvin Pete and Sifford and all these other great black golfers, now that you're at this point now where Tiger, is getting up there as an elder statesman, just that whole run from back there with Sifford and all those guys up to Tiger, what has it been like? What has the journey been like? And what can you, if you had to leave something back as a legacy to tell people about this run for African-American golfers, men or women, what would be your soliloquy to them?
Now that is, Mike, boy. Where did he dig that one up from, Rick? The organization,
like,
by the way,
deep.
I see he is real deep. Just as an aside, the name of that organization was the Wake Robin Golf Club, The oldest women's golf club in the country was a black women's golf organization, the Wake Robin. Okay, now to answer your question, Mike. It was a hell of a journey for me. I mean, really, realizing that you know, we had been shunned in the game, I realized that very early in life as I came up as a junior golfer, and I was playing with kind of a makeshift set of golf clubs and was a caddy and playing against country club kids. I knew the discrepancies. I knew the inequality. I saw it firsthand because there was only one golf course that we could play as blacks in Asheville. So I knew what was happening. But then to hear the stories about, Charlie Sifford and Bill Spiller and Teddy Rhodes and all these great golfers, and the fact that they faced the same hardships, even worse, back in the day in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And all they wanted to do was play a game and try to earn a living playing that game. And to be refused that opportunity really made my blood boil. And going from those individuals interviewing Charlie Sifford and Bill Spiller's son and getting those stories about them, and then talking to James Black and Bobby Strobel and Jim Dent and all of the golfers that I knew growing up, I carried that in with me when I started covering Tiger and realizing that Tiger's experience was totally different from theirs, totally different, even though he, was not a child of privilege, they had already paved the way for him. And he was extremely grateful. That was the thing that I found along the way, from going all the way back to, the beginning of when we started playing this game back in the late 1800s, all the way through Charlie Sifford and Bill Spiller and all those guys. They all paid homage to those who came before them. And to hear Tiger, when I interviewed him, say the same thing when he won his Masters for the first time in 1997. Mm-hmm. He credited Charlie Sifford and Teddy Rhodes and Bill Spiller with paving the way for him. That was the connection that I wanted. And that was the connection that every time you see Tiger win, every time you see him play, if your mind can only take you back and you see Charlie Sifford swinging the club, or you see Teddy Rhodes chipping in, or you see Bill Spiller determined. He was a very determined player, a cerebral player. That's where Tiger, that's his bloodline. That's our bloodline. And that's why, I don't care what you think about Tiger, that you have to appreciate that.
Right, and that's why all the politics, all that aside, I pull for him, because every birdie represents something. That every victory is a victory for all those guys that paved the way for him. And I'm so glad to hear you say how he was appreciative of that.
Exactly.
And understood that history. You know, I may have said this on the show before, when my father, who's a golf pro in Nashville, Tennessee, when he retired, Tiger presented him with a plaque, for his 43 years of service as a golf professional, which is in the Ted Rhodes clubhouse right now. So
your dad was a hell of a player. A lot of people don't know that.
Was.
Your dad was one hell of a player.
I'm sorry I didn't get all of that. I got a little of it, but not enough of it. Peter, it's so good to hear you say that, because you hear all the stuff you hear about Tiger, and, I hate his political stances and everything. But, man, when he's on that team, he's representing our community.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And that's, our sports heroes Sometimes I think we forget they're just human beings, just like us. And we're all different, you know. And I've defended Tiger for so many years, and I will continue to defend him because I understand him, you know. I just understand him, you know. I can appreciate where he's coming from, huh?
Of course, you know him better than most, and you've had a chance to be around him, so you have a better perspective than a lot of us.
There's a private Tiger and there's a public Tiger. And the public Tiger knows business. You know, golf is his business. It's his life and it's his business. And, you know, the two do not mix. That's just how it is.
Yeah.
He has private opinions, and some of them are very, they're all personal, but believe me, if he were to open up to you and tell you what he really felt about certain issues, you would see where his heart really is. You know, he can't afford to do that.
I think about
not Muhammad
LeBron
Ali.
James gets so much flack for, if he goes getting in a layup line with his son, and you look at all the great things this guy does off the court. I just saw the other day he rented a taco truck out and to feed the firefighters up the out your way, Mike. And
out here. Yeah.
You know, I guess when you're at that level of greatness and fame, everything you do is under the bright lights, especially in the days of social media.
There's no doubt about it. But I love LeBron. That's my guy. I mean, I don't like the teams that he plays for, but that's just because, you know, I'm an old guy and I grew up as a Boston Celtics fan. I know you guys don't like to hear that, but that's just the truth. Okay, I want you all to study the history of the league now. Mike, you should know this. Study the history. You know the history of the league, then you know who the Celtics really are.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Despite Boston.
Hey, Pete, have you ever read the book Red and Me by Bill Russell?
No. I haven't. I should have, but I haven't.
Oh, my goodness. It is really good. I got to be sure I got that title right. But Bill Russell wrote a book about his relationship with Red Auerbach, and it is really a great insight into the relationship of those two men. And you and Mike know Bill Russell did not take any stuff from anybody.
Absolutely not.
In his life.
My guy. I'm telling you the truth, man. My guy, Bill Russell. I love him to death. I met him in Boston. I played in a Kennedy tournament, and I met him. And, man, it's one of the thrills of a lifetime. Several people.
Yes,
you know, I don't do autographs and stuff like that. I've never asked. I've asked for one autograph in my life, and that was the L.A. Dodgers manager, Tommy Lasorda. I saw him in the airport in L.A., and my son was a big baseball fan, and especially the Dodgers, which is my rival. I'm a big San Francisco Giants fan. But I asked for his autograph for my baby boy, and and that's the only one I've ever asked for.
Yeah. Yeah. A good handshake would do for me.
Yeah.
Well, Pete, digressing back to Tiger, so you had a chance to meet Earl, and did you also meet his mom? Did you get, an insight from those two or how he formed to the person he is now?
Oh, yeah. Well, she and I talk to this day. We'll talk. I may go a month without talking to her, but I'll call her. She'll call me, and we catch up. And we have for years and years. But Earl, I got to know Earl really well when I was helping him write his book, Training a Tiger. And I eulogized Earl. I was one of three people who eulogized Earl. That's how tight I've been with the family. It's like my family. You know, that's why I protect Tiger. That's why I am always going to support him to the doggone end. I don't care. You know, people talk about me being a homer and, I'm biased and whatever. Yes, I'm biased. You know, yes, I am. What you going to do about it? I don't work for anybody. I work for myself. I can write what I want to write and say what I want to say, and that's the freedom that I enjoy. So,
hey,
you
hey,
know,
we
but
gotta
I do know
get out of here, man. We got to get out of here, but we got to come back, and because we only scratched the surface of this conversation regarding not only Tiger Woods but black golf in America. And once again, to our listeners out there, both in the States and international, go pick up Pete McDaniel's Uneven Lies, the heroic story of African Americans in golf. If you're a golf fan, even if you're not, the journey and the struggle that these men made will
and
inspire
women.
You. You know,
these men and
yeah,
women.
And women, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. So, mm-hmm. Pete, we promise us you'll come back and visit.
I will. Just give me a call. You've got my digits.
All right, my brother. Thank you so much.
All right. Okay, guys. Take
pleasure.
Care now. I enjoyed it.
All right. Yeah, you too.
That was golf writer Pete McDaniel, the author of Uneven Lies. It was good sharing some time with him. I mean, he has spent time covering Tiger Woods from the beginning of his career throughout. And he, as you can tell, he knows the family
right.
close and personal. So it's good to get his perspective. And now we're leaving one legend, and we're going to bring in another legend, NBA, ABA basketball legend, and a great friend of the show, the one and only Mr. Mac Calvin. Mac, welcome to the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. You're on with Mike Robinson and Ricky Hampton. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing wonderful, fellas. It's so wonderful to talk to you guys again, and it's certainly a delight. And I've got my baseball game on mute, and I'm talking to
you.
Yeah.
You know what? And I'm glad you mentioned that because we need to acknowledge that the Astros are, what, about 5 innings away from possibly winning another World Series. But, of course, we've seen the Nationals come back from the dead. At least in 2 series against the Brewers and against the Cardinals. So, but yeah, the Astros could win their second title tonight. So you got to keep that in
yeah,
mind.
Well, there's one fan in Houston that you know, they got the paramedics around him that's probably having a mass heart attack if they lose, and that's the guy that put $10 million. Bet on the Houston Astros to win the World Series.
That's right.
That?
I heard about that.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
It's the guy that owns a furniture store in Houston, Texas. And he started off by betting $4.5 million, and he couldn't get any of these book places, so now it's up to $10 million. So if he wins, he wins something like $4 or $5 million. But you can believe
that
apparently fight around that guy if he loses the series.
Yeah, I know.
Hey, Mac, before we get into the current NBA season, we were talking with the great golf writer Pete McDaniels a couple of minutes ago, and Pete talked about meeting Bill Russell. And, you know, for our listeners out there, can you tell us a little bit about Bill Russell's legacy and his impact on the game that goes all the way up until today?
Well, I think that, you know, the tremendous respect for Bill Russell and myself and other former professional basketball player, ABA and NBA, we rode off the shoulders and back of Bill Russell. I mean, he set the tone. He obviously in the same speaking terms as Jackie Robinson. People don't realize that what he had to go through. I went through a lot myself in the late 60s, early 70s of being an African-American athlete, but Bill by that time had paved the way back in the late 50s, early 60s. And so a lot of props go out to him. I guess the one thing that I never really knew why he didn't sign autographs. And I've never asked him. I see Bill all the time at the NBA All-Star Games, and I've never asked him. I just have had a lot of respect for him, and I just, you know, I've always acknowledged him by calling him Mr. Russell. But he really was just really a great man, on and off the court, and people didn't realize how much prejudice went on during that time in Boston. But you know, he had a great franchise behind him. When you look at Red Auerbach and the owner that stood behind him, so Bill Russell just was a great guy. And if you guys don't mind me just saying this, I listened to your last guest, and he talked about the only autograph that he ever got was from Tommy Lasorda. And when I was a kid out in Los Angeles, I used to go to the Dodgers game early 60s, when I was probably 12, 13 years old. And I used to have a second baseman by the name of Charlie Neal, play with Maury Wills.
Yeah.
Maury was a shortstop.
Yeah.
And I raised enough money to get a ticket to go to the game, and I waited, you know, an hour or so after the game to get Mr. Neal, Charlie Neal. And he told me, "No, son, I'm not signing your autograph." And it was really a disappointing. It really hurt my father. And I had no idea that I would go on and play professional basketball some 10 years later. And I made a point that I would always sign an autograph once I got to the pros. I don't care how long I had to stay out there. It was my responsibility and duty to sign the autographs of kids and parents and people that wanted my autograph. I wasn't bigger than the game. And so that really bothered me. And and then now these guys, they sign autographs. You can't even tell who their names are. They just scribble. I just think you got to take pride in signing an autograph.
I agree.
Hey, Mike, I'll let you start the conversation.
Mac, going back to Bill and Will, you had a chance to meet Will also, right?
Oh, I knew Will very well. Yes.
Okay. Now, did you ever converse with them as Kappa? Has that ever come up, or has it always been more like basketball? Had you ever talked about, you know, being part of the frat, the greatest frat?
Never did. No. You know, in fact, you just mentioned that. I didn't know that both of them were the greatest frats. You're right. I didn't know that Bill Russell and Will Chamberlain were, you know, Kappa brothers. Didn't know that.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, next time you see Bill, put it on him, Mac.
He would remember. Yeah, Bill. Yeah, I'll put it on him, but he probably will. You know, want to know why I'm shaking his hand. You know, Bill is really close down to take care of that. You know, he's really slowed
Mac,
down.
Your thoughts, we're a couple of weeks into the season, just your general thoughts, and then we'll get into some specific teams. What are your first impressions of the year?
Well, you know, I'm not getting too hyped because teams haven't played five games yet, but I think the predictability is the fact those teams that people talk would be – talked about being the top 10 teams have prevailed. I think if there's a little disappointment, it would probably be the Houston Rockets, the way they performed so far. But my pick and my recommendation all along, I still think the Denver Nuggets will be the team to beat in the West, and along with the Clippers. I really don't. Yes, I do. I really think that they are more experienced. They got a stronger bench, and they got the best center, second best center in the league, with Jokic behind Embiid. They just have a well-balanced team, veteran players, now some experienced players, and I think Murray is going to be one of the top surprises this year in the NBA. Jamal Murray, third year, I think, out of University of Kentucky. They're pretty solid, great coach. And I'm not saying that because I used to play for the Denver Nuggets. I just think that they're just primed to, if they stay healthy, to get out of the West. I think it'll boil down to the L.A. Clippers and Denver Nuggets. The Clippers are very good now. Don't get me wrong. And when they get Paul George back, you know, they're going to be awesome. But what I like about the Clippers is defensively. I mean, they really clamp down on you, and they have no weaknesses from a defensive standpoint.
I just wonder about their playoff experience and those big game situations.
Well, I think, Ricky, when you talk about playoff experiences, I mean, how deep can you get with Paul George, who was with the Indiana Pacers for many years, got to the finals against LeBron James in Cleveland?
I'm sorry, Mac. I was thinking about Denver. Denver. Yeah, go ahead.
I think last year when they went seven games in the semifinals with Portland and lost it at home, I think that was a very valuable learning lesson. You know, and they had it right in their hands. You know, obviously they would have gotten to the finals. They were not going to be a match against the Warriors. But I think that experience really meant a lot and will pay dividends this year. Again, it's an 82-game season. You got to stay healthy. And on the other flip side of that, the other best team, the two best teams, in my opinion, is the L.A. Clippers and the Denver Nuggets. You can talk about Portland. You can talk about Utah. You can talk about Houston. But those teams, in my opinion, separate themselves far greater than any other team. Now, they got to stay healthy. But Kawhi Leonard is a superstar. He is. I didn't realize how good this kid was. He's special.
Yeah, I think he's really reaching his prime. But I can't believe you haven't mentioned the Lakers.
No, I haven't, and won't. I think they're probably the fourth or fifth best team in the West.
Oh, man.
You know? And here's a lot
this
of reasons.
This is sacrilege here.
Yeah, and let me give you the reason why. I'm not just going to throw that out there, Mike. And all right. Let me tell you, my 47 years in the NBA and professional basketball, ABA as a coach, player, I have never, and even in sports, Father Time has never lost a battle, to my knowledge. And on December 30th, LeBron James will be 35 years old. And Father Time will catch up with him. And then he's only played, last year missed 25 games. Due to a hamstring injury, a groin injury. And then you have Anthony Davis, who is a great player, but the kid has only played 70% of his game in the 6 years that he's been in the league. So if you have a load management issue with him this year, if he misses 60% of the game, I think you're in trouble. I think the Lakers are in trouble. They don't have a good bench. They got a bunch of long tooth guys, that's there, Rondo and Dwight Howard and some of the other guys, but they don't have a consistent bench. And that's the fact. I don't think they're better than Utah. I think Utah is much better than them. I think that Houston will be a good team, but I don't see Houston getting out of the second round. And those are my thoughts. Now, I may be wrong.
Now, you do realize that Kawhi Leonard also did load management last year, and the reason why Toronto stayed afloat because they were already a good team, whereas the Lakers fell totally apart when LeBron was out.
Michael, let me tell you this. Let me put this on record right now.
Okay.
If there's a load management and Anthony Davis or LeBron James missed 15 games in the West this year, they are in serious trouble. You can do that in the East. Okay, Kawhi could get away with that. But if Kawhi and the Clippers, they try to go load management here now in the West, oh, man, you know, the team that gets to the seventh or eighth place position, see, they're going to win 48 to 51 games. You know, you can't.
Well, Mac, okay, say you're coaching that roster. Can you put a minute restriction on some of these guys? Would that help? Here in Detroit, I think Soto just blasted one for our baseball fans.
Yeah, Verlander's losing it again.
Verlander, he's 0-5 about to go 0-6. I mean, he got all that. 3-2 Washington. But I'm going to get back to Mac. You got that roster. Did you put a minute restriction on some of these guys? Here in Detroit, Casey said Derrick Rose will not play more than 25 minutes in a game. Could you do something like that with LeBron and Davis? How would you manage that?
Well, I think you got to pick your poison. I think that throughout each game, you have to look and see if you're winning by a certain amount of points or if you're losing, get those star guys out, you know, and certainly on back-to-back games. Let's say tonight you're playing, let's say if you're the Lakers, you're playing against the Clippers. So that's a game you want to win. And tomorrow night, you're back-to-back, you're playing against Sacramento at Sacramento or against Memphis. So you play LeBron whatever amount of minutes, 34, 35 minutes tonight, and then maybe you're only playing 22, 25 minutes tomorrow. So those are the kind of strategy and game plans that I think minute restriction you have to go on those players. You know, so you gotta pick your poison in my opinion. But man, when I was playing and even up to 10 years ago, what about load restriction? What is that, man? Just go play. You got to play.
Hey, and y'all were flying, and Mac, y'all flying around coach on regular commercial flights too, huh?
Yeah, propeller airplane, you know, five stops. And to get to, you know, where you can get there in 1 hour on a regular flight, you had five stops, you know. So, but, you know, that here again, these guys are coming off the back of us players in those days, you know. And things have changed, and I'm all for the modern player and everything that they have. And you know, I don't knock that. I like Charles Barkley and those guys are not the modern day players. It's a different era.
Mm-hmm. Mike.
Yeah, it's a different. But you know, it's these are great young players, and they deserve everything that they're getting. But I just don't believe. You know, I see. Well, this is your third or fourth game in Detroit. Now Reggie Jackson is out. I mean, what did he play the first game and then hasn't played anymore?
Blake hadn't even suited up yet.
I know, you know, Blake, unfortunately, may have a short career. He's not going to be a 12, 14, 15-year guy because of all the early injuries he had. I mean, it's just the way it is, you know.
Mike, you got something, Matt?
Well, just back to the father time thing, let's not forget that we got a quarterback who just won another Super Bowl, his sixth, and he's doing it at an advanced age. So who's to say that LeBron can't get another championship or two out of himself?
It won't happen in this era. You know, he may get it in the team, but he won't get it playing in the NBA. You know, he may be Y2K or 2-3 or whatever that game those games are, but he won't get it. You talking about Tom Brady? Hey, listen, he's got a great line. All he's got to do is, you know, check off Omaha four, you know, and he doesn't move in the pocket. He's got people blocking for him and protecting him. Yeah, he's not going to run. You know, he would be out today if he was like that kid in Kansas City. They catches up with you, but he's a smart guy. They've got a great line. They got a great culture. They protect him. So he's got another couple more years. In my opinion, you know, so I love to watch him play. I mean, I was not a, you know, because of the cheating and things that they've done in the past, I wasn't a big New England fan, but I am now because they just find a way to, they find ways to win, and they have a winning culture. And if you don't fit in as a player, you're gone. Ask Antonio Brown, you know. So I just love.
That's true, Matt. That's true. Well, we're only going to keep you a couple of more minutes, Mac, here on the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com radio show. But I want to look east for a second before we get out of here. To me, Philly stands to be the best team. Now, you talk about injuries. You know, their best player has trouble staying healthy. But you think they can get away with missing him a few games in the East?
Well, no question.
Talking about Joel Embiid.
They made a smart move by bringing in Al Horford, who can play the five position. So they've got great backup. I think their biggest problem is shooting the ball. I don't think they have really great depth in 3-point shooters. I still think Milwaukee is the best team in the East.
Wait a minute,
I still
man.
Think,
Ben Simmons hit a three-pointer a couple of days. Well, that was in preseason. He hit a three-pointer and got a standing ovation.
Yeah, well, that must have been a last-second Hail Mary shot, you know, because he is not a three-point shooter. And I think that's the problem. And they don't have anyone that can stretch the defense. And I just think that – and I love Tobias Harris, but, man, for whatever reason, guys, he is so inconsistent. And although the team that won it last year, you're still going to have to put them away. I'm talking about the Toronto Raptors. They're still a very good team, you know.
Well, Milwaukee should have put them away last year.
Yeah, because they had not been there before, Mike. They were like a deer in a headlight. They jumped
literally
to the lead with five games to go, and they lost four out of five games at home. So I don't know. I think they're much better this year, and you know, it's nothing like getting that playoff experience under your belt. But they got the second best player in the league, in my opinion, and Kawhi Leonard being the number one, and the Greek Freak number two.
Well, that's it. Yeah, that's you and Derek.
Yeah. Well, hey, well, who do you think is the best player in the league, Mike?
It's still LeBron.
LeBron.
It's still LeBron.
Yeah, well. Well, I tell
you. That's a subjective thing anyway, right?
I mean,
because the best player dominate the game. If this team doesn't play well with him, they're going to lose. Michael Jordan was
amazing.
The best player in the league the first 7 years of his career. Every time he stepped on the court, he was the best player, and he got his butt whooped on a consistent basis because he didn't have enough around. When
that's
he got
correct.
More around him, he won't. So the best player stuff is really not a big deal, in my opinion.
No, no, no. He's an MVP player like James Harden. Is James Harden because he's going to shoot the ball 30 times and score average 28, 9, 30 points a game? Is he the best player? Absolutely not. You know.
Hey, Max,
do you think
you could have played with James Harden?
Who? I could have?
Yeah.
It's been difficult for me because, I'm a point guard. You got to handle the ball. I'm a creator. You know, that's why they set Paul's name back, you know. And I think the thing with Russ now can handle the ball. But it will be difficult to play with James Harden. I mean, he's – and especially in their offense. And so I could not. You know, I think he's a very selfish player personally. You know, I just think he wants to get his numbers, and that's pretty much it. Hey, guys, if you don't mind, I know you got to go pretty soon, but I wanted to talk about the Kyrie Irving situation. You know,
oh,
I don't know if you heard.
Yes, I meant to ask you about that.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, there was an article in the paper today that there's already some grumbling in the Nets locker room about Kyrie Irving's mood swing, and. So, and I'll be honest with you, I love his game, but I think he's another selfish player, you know.
Yeah.
I think those guys, they've gotten beyond the game, you know. It's all about themselves. And I mean, for only being there for 2 weeks now, the season starts, and you've got some problems. And I know that the players in Boston, they couldn't wait till he got out of there. In fact, I think I heard some of them helped him move, you know.
Yeah. But
Mac, my opinion is that shot that he hit out here against the Warriors was a gift and a curse. So I think it was a gift that's the greatest shot he'll ever hit in his life. But then all of a sudden people got in his ear and said, hey, man, you should have been MVP, not LeBron. Because, you know, people always want to somehow
totally
knock LeBron
agree.
Off. And then all of a sudden now it's like, hey, man, I don't want to play here anymore. I want my own team. And then he saw that. Man, I need to appreciate what LeBron did. Now, he went to 8 straight finals, carrying the team, dealing with knuckleheads like me. So,
but
then,
you know what? He kind of said that. He kind of said
exactly.
that last year.
Right.
Is that
exactly.
He didn't really understand what he was asking for.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the same with Kobe. But that's the consciousness of these guys, you know, of these players.
Mm-hmm.
Same with KD. They're so sensitive and fickle, and it's got to be all about them. And that's a problem. And it's got to be about winning. I mean, Steph Curry could say, "Look, I don't want to be here. We're gonna tank. We're gonna lose." But the kid is—he's looking. They sold him on. We're gonna build this franchise back up. And when Klay Thompson get back, we're gonna be fine. But Kyrie Irving, I mean, I think the kid, and this may someone may pick this up, back out. But I think he's got some real serious emotional issues.
Yeah.
I really do, and I think it's going to affect that great young ball club at your great young ball club in Brooklyn.
Well,
I
would say both of
them. KD too. KD too.
Mike Robinson called that out a couple of years ago about Kyrie.
Yeah.
Before anybody was even talking about it.
Yeah, I agree. There's no question about it, and. You know, the problem is KD will be out for a year, and maybe he comes back. You know, guys, the problem I have with the NBA, the media technology, you know, this technology, I think that everybody's got to fix it and sit down.
Did we lose him?
Yeah,
hello?
I'm still here.
Oh, okay. We lost.
Could you say that again, Matt?
Yeah.
I think that because of so many opinions that the players are speaking out now, you know, I think it's an issue. And you go with the guy in Houston who pretty much started. I think that the commissioner, a lot of players that have their own opinion, which is nothing wrong with it, but you
right.
know. I think the culture has changed with so many people being able to vent their frustration or say what they want to say. I still think it's still a game, and you got to respect the game and the culture of the game. And I think it's the issue right now.
My thing about that is that when I saw all these people, including black people, jumping out on LeBron like he did something wrong, I'm like, wait a minute. So you expect him to just be in lockstep with Hong Kong? I mean, he doesn't know what the whole issue is with that. So to sit there and say, well, this is your moment to say, hey, I'm down with Hong Kong, that you can't make somebody have that opinion. That's what I was upset about. And Maury, who put the tweet out, then later deleted it. But, of course, you know you can't ever really delete anything on the Internet. But then – you know, so he wasn't that serious about it. He deletes it. He didn't stand by his statement. And then you got these guys in China. You never know what could happen to them over there. Just like with LeVar Ball's son when he was over there. You know, that could have gone a whole different way. They could have said, nah, man, we ain't letting this dude out. He's going to sit over here for 20 years for coming to our country and disrespecting him. And that's how they felt like America was doing when this guy says this tweet, like, hey, man, why are you guys in our political business over here, you know?
Absolutely.
Especially when
Absolutely.
You are the pipeline for China to the NBA, the Houston Rockets. So that's why that whole thing just was ridiculous. And, of course, LeBron gets all the blame. Like, well, he could have said something different. I'm like, nah. We're not being fair to him on that one.
Well, I'm not worried about athletes' opinions on world affairs. I want to see him play well. I want to see, you know, what they can do on the field. And everybody got different political tastes. I was just talking about Tiger Woods. I hate his politics. I hate the fact that he hangs out with the current president. But I still cheer for him on the golf course because of what he represents for the history of black golfers. So
right.
I can separate the two.
Yeah, and again, it goes back to my earlier statement when I said I think there's too many opinions. I mean, we have a lot of crisis and issues here in the United States where players are speaking out about, you know, the things. We have issues with homelessness. We have issues with educational component. You know, our kids are not getting a good education. So what I think personally should have happened, Michelle Roberts, who is the president of the NBA Players Association, they should have come out with a strong statement. That should not have been on the back of LeBron James. And,
right.
And because these guys are making so much money. You didn't see Kobe come out and say anything. You didn't see Kevin Durant.
Right.
You didn't see a lot of, because they're making millions and millions of dollars going over to China during the offseason with
right.
the studio.
Yeah.
You know, and so well, I just think personally, why make a big issue of something that happened in another country? And I, you know, I think it's wrong from a human standpoint. So we have a lot of serious human issues here as African Americans, you know, as minorities, you know. So if you're going to speak on something, have a platform where you can, where the truth is going to come out and is going to resonate to so many people. That's just, you know, my opinion on that.
Well, Mac and Mike, it has been another great hour, and we actually went a little over tonight, but when you got a guy like Matt Calvin, you stretch the time. My brother, we hope to talk to you throughout the NBA season, Matt.
Well, thank you. I look forward to it, and it's going to be an interesting season. It's probably one of the best, you know, because the West is going to be strong.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah.
I don't know about them Lakers not being – you got them five? I can't go with that. We'll have to touch bases again on that.
Well, all I can say, Mike, keep your money in your pocket. Don't bet against the Lakers. You'll go broke, pal.
All right. Well, for Ricky Hampton, right. Mike Robinson, and NBA legend Matt, and NBA AVA legend Matt Calvin, this has been the African American Athlete.com. Talk to you next Tuesday. Good night. God bless.
All right. Peace.
Thank you.